Today is February the 2nd, 2022. It's Groundhog Day. Did the groundhog see a shadow? It's 02022022. It's a near palindrome. Welcome to the award-winning personal computer show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. That's prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. We are nearing 2 years now of at-home lockdown, which was begun back in March 19th, 2020. I'm eagerly looking forward to returning into the studio for live calls from you, the listening audience. In the meantime, you can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Camera that can see through or around anything. Researchers from Northwestern Engineering Department have invented a new high-resolution camera that can see around corners and through objects, even skin, fog, or a human skull. The process is called synthetic wavelength holography, and it's a new method that works by indirectly scattering light onto hidden objects, which then scatters again and travels back to the camera. An algorithm then reconstructs that scattered light signal in a way that reveals hidden objects. The team says that due to its high temporal resolution, the method also could potentially see fast-moving objects like cars speeding around corners or the human heart beating through a chest. The idea of photographing or visualizing a subject around a corner versus seeing an organ inside a human body may sound like completely different challenges that would require different solutions, but the team says that they are actually closely related since both deal with scattering media in which light hits an object and scatters in a manner that a direct image of the object can no longer be seen. Synthetic wavelength holography is part of the new field of research called non-line-of-sight, that's NLOS imaging. The method developed by the Northwestern researchers can rapidly photograph full-field images of large areas with what they describe as submillimeter precision. With this level of resolution, the computational camera could potentially image through the skin to see even the tiniest capillaries at work. While the team says that the obvious use cases for the technology exist in medical imaging, they also argue that it could be used as an early warning tool in car navigation systems or industrial inspection in small spaces. The team says that possible applications are endless. The technology will usher in a new wave of imaging capabilities. Our current sensor prototypes use visible or infrared light, but the principle is universal and could be extended to other wavelengths. For example, the same method could be applied to radio waves for space exploration or underwater acoustic imaging. It can be applied to many areas, and we've only scratched the surface. Motorola's wireless Android Auto dongle. Wireless Android Auto support is something really seen built into cars, but the rise of third-party dongles has made it much easier to bring this functionality to cars that don't already have it. A new wireless Android Auto dongle under the Motorola brand has been launched. The Motorola MA1 is a simple USB dongle with one key purpose, to add wireless Android Auto support to any car that already supports the wired form. The MA1 is the first dongle that's officially certified by Google. This dongle lacks the extra steps other products currently require, which is setting up the MA1 is as simple as plugging it into your car's USB port. Your car must have a USB-A port, as the dongle cable is not removable. Once plugged in, the next step is to pair the dongle through your phone's Bluetooth menu. It appears under the name Android Auto with some additional characters. Unfortunately, there's no automatic prompt for this, such as Google's Fast Pair would provide. The only change you may have to do on your phone is to ensure the toggle for the wireless Android Auto is enabled, which should be the case by default on modern phones. Not long after pairing to Bluetooth, the dongle will automatically trigger the Android Auto wireless setup process on your phone and your car, with prompts appearing on both screens to help you get started. You will be able to get the Motorola MA1 paired and running in a matter of, well, 2 or so minutes. Reconnecting to the dongle after the car has been powered off takes about 30 seconds. Apple updates for macOS 12.2 and iPadOS 15.4. Apple's new universal control feature for Macs. The feature available in the latest iPadOS and macOS developer betas lets you use a single cursor and keyboard across iPad and Macs. Now available as part of the macOS Monterey 12.3 and an iPadOS 15.4 developer betas. The feature creates a bridge between Macs and iPads that many have been waiting for Apple to build. Universal Control lets you use a single mouse and keyboard on both an iPad and Mac and drop content between the two. This way you can send photos or video clips from your tablet to your laptop and vice versa without using AirDrop, uploading to the cloud, or some other workaround. Apple claimed that there was no setup required. You just need to do the basic login to both devices using the same Apple ID and ensure that they are both up to date. For now, you can only use the feature on iPad Apple's developer program, but it'll eventually be a default feature on iPad and Mac. Apple updates for the iPadOS 15.4. MacBooks are experiencing battery drain in sleep mode. The problem seems to be caused by Bluetooth devices. If you just downloaded the latest version of macOS 12.2, keep an eye on your MacBook battery life. Apple laptop owners are reporting across various forums and social media platforms that their MacBooks are experiencing excessive battery drain while in sleep mode. A software bug related to Bluetooth accessories appear to be waking these devices from their energy-saving slumber, and users have reported that the macOS 12.2 update released earlier this week makes a Mac battery life drop from 100% to zero while in sleep mode. One affected user posted a chart showing how the battery started to drain even after the screen was no longer in use. Several others chimed in, noting similar behavior on their devices since installing macOS 12.2, and some say they've experienced drain while running the macOS 12.3 beta. It's not clear when the apparent bug wiggles its way into Apple's desktop OS, but some users say issues arose in earlier versions of macOS, and while others are reporting this problem on newer M1 MacBooks. Intel power models are also affected. Apple is aware of these problems. The company's support team has responded to disgruntled Mac owners by providing support documents with instructions on how to optimize battery life or check battery health, but nothing that fixes this issue. The leading theory for what's causing the problem is that Bluetooth devices are waking these Macs from sleep, though it's not clear why that might be happening. Users tried finding the cause and discovered in Terminal that Bluetooth accessories are causing dark wake from deep idle, resulting in Macs that repeatedly wake from sleep. While Apple hasn't confirmed as much, those who are suffering from the battery drain problem say that disabling Bluetooth or disconnecting wireless accessories are effective, albeit annoying workarounds. Others have avoided waking up to a dead MacBook by keeping it plugged in overnight. However, they're warned that this could harm the health of the battery. If there is a silver lining, it's that this battery problem is likely caused by a software bug rather than a hardware issue that might require returning or replacing your laptop. Apple should soon work to quickly release a patch. Until then, you might think twice about updating your MacBook. And if you're already experiencing problems, try disabling Bluetooth before you turn it in for the night. Intel $1.2 billion, that's with a capital B, antitrust fine was overturned. Intel has a $1.2 billion antitrust fine overturned by the European Union Court. The fine was handed out by the European Commission, the executive arm of the EU, on the basis that Intel had unfairly tried to squeeze out its rivals. Specifically, the Commission claimed that Intel abused its dominant position on the worldwide market for x86 processors between 2002 and 2007. That's over 10 years ago. The General Court, a constituent court of the Court of Justice of the European Union, rejected the fine last Wednesday. A prominent European Union court has overturned a $1.2 billion antitrust fine that was levied against U.S. chipmaker Intel in 2009. The fine was handed out by the European Commission, the executive arm of the EU, on the basis that Intel had unfairly tried to squeeze out its rivals. The Commission had claimed that Intel abused its dominant position on the worldwide market for x86 data center processors between 2002 and 2007 by implementing a strategy intended to exclude competitors from the market. But the General Court, a constituent court of the Court of Justice of the European Union, rejected the fine last Wednesday, saying the Commission didn't do a proper economic analysis of a rebate scheme. General Court said in a press release published on its website that the European Commission analysis is incomplete and does not make it possible to establish the requisite legal standard that the rebates at issue were capable of having or likely to have anti-competitive effects. In 2014, the General Court upheld the Commission's 2009 verdict. However, it was subsequently told by the EU Court of Justice, Europe's highest court, in 2017 to re-examine Intel's appeal. An Intel spokesperson said that the company is currently reviewing the decision and they will provide further comment when they have completed their initial review. The 46th Annual Trenton Computer Festival, TCF 2022, is set for Saturday, March the 19th, 2022. The theme of the festival is Disrupting Climate Change with Technology. It will be held at the College of New Jersey in Trenton, New Jersey. The keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, and he is the co-director of the University Office of Climate Action. He is a climate and sea level scientist and climate policy scholar at Rutgers University's Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and Rutgers Institute of Earth and Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. One of the speakers at the festival is Rezwan Razani. She is a writer, planner, game designer, and the founder of Footprint to Wings. She will be giving a talk at the Trenton Computer Festival titled Metrics and Mindset to Disrupt Climate Change, Introducing the First Gigawatt Down, How We Can Use Metaphors and Metrics Together with Databases and User Interfaces and Augmenting Reality and Other Computational Tools and Templates that Can Help Get a Clear Sense of Options to Negotiating Viable Solutions. TCF will be a full day of learning and fun. For more information, you can go to tcf-nj.org. Back to the future with old music. Old songs now represent 70% of the U.S. music market. Even worse, the new music market is actually shrinking. Old songs now represent 70% of the U.S. music market according to the latest numbers from MRC Data, a music analytics firm. The working musician today should look at these figures with concern. The news gets worse. The new music market is actually shrinking. All the growth in the market is coming from old songs. The 200 most popular new tracks now regularly account for less than 5% of total streams. That rate was twice as high just 3 years ago. The mix of songs actually purchased by consumers is even more tilted towards older music. The current list of most downloaded tracks on iTunes is filled with names of bands from the previous century, such as Creedence Clearwater Revival and The Police. The audience seems to be embracing the hits of decades past. Success was always short-lived in the music business, but now even new songs that become bona fide hits can pass unnoticed by much of the population. Only songs released in the past 18 months get classified as new in the MRC database, so people could conceivably be listening to a lot of 2-year-old songs rather than 60-year-old songs. Even if they did, the fact would still represent a repudiation of the pop culture industry, which is almost always entirely focused on what's happening right now. The entire business model of the music industry is built on promoting new songs, yet all the evidence indicates that few listeners are paying attention. The declining TV audience for the Grammy show underscores this shift. In 2021, viewership for the ceremony collapsed 53% from the previous year, from 18.7 million viewers to 8.8 million viewers. It was the least watched Grammy broadcast of all time. About 98% of people ages 18 to 49 had something better to do than watch the biggest music celebration of the year. A decade ago, 40 million people watched the Grammy Awards, but now the devoted fans of this event are starting to resemble a tiny subculture. More people pay attention to streams of video games, which now gets 30 million daily visitors, or the latest reality TV show. Some believe that this trend is just short-term, perhaps caused by the pandemic. But consider what's happening on the music front. The leading areas of investment in the music business is old songs. Investment firms are getting into bidding wars to buy publishing catalogs from aging rock and pop stars. The song catalogs in most demand are by musicians who are now in their 70s or 80s. Bob Dylan, Paul Simon, and people like Bruce Springsteen. Or already dead musicians David Bowie and James Brown. Even major record labels are participating in the rush to old music. Universal Music, Sony Music, Warner Music, and others are buying up publishing catalogs and investing huge sums in old tunes. The best-selling physical format in music is now the vinyl LP, believe it or not. The vinyl LP business now is over $1 billion, which is more than 70 years old. Record stores are caught up in the same time warp. Now they make more money from vinyl reissues and used LPs. Radio stations are putting fewer new songs into their rotation. Dead musicians are now coming back to life in virtual form via holograms and deepfake music. Back to the future with older music. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell, Complaints for IT, Part 5 of 5.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we discuss all of the different relationships and intricacies of information technology in the workplace and how they impact you. And this has been a series. We're talking about the top 5 complaints for IT departments. We started off with the helpless desk. My kid knows more than you. And why do we have to change our passwords and all of these different lockouts and password problems? I mean, we're not working, you know, this isn't national defense, except actually in one of my companies that I've worked at, it was. So, yeah, this next one is, this is a common thing, and this goes across multiple areas, multiple disciplines within IT. Why is my computer slow? Why is the network slow? Why is my application slow? Why is this slow? And there's so many different reasons. And there's so many different levels of intricacy woven into this overall concept of what is slow, what is fast, what needs to be done, what can be done. And a lot of this works into just the behemoth that we're talking about of information gathering, information processing, and distributing that information in clear, concise formats for management. We have to track. Let's say you sell 1,000 different widgets and you sell roughly 1,000 of those, of each of those widgets every year. Management wants to know which ones are making us money. Management wants to know which ones aren't making us money. Management wants to know where we can streamline things, where we can make more money, where we can do a lot of different things. But to do that, we need all of this information. What happens? Well, yes, that means that there is a certain level of information bloat that occurs as we gather every single little bit of information that we can. Sometimes we go too far in gathering information. Sometimes we don't go far enough. So IT has to decide, okay, what do we ask? What don't we ask? And there's a whole intricacy of details that we have to go through on that one. And I don't want to spend too much time in that direction. But we then move into the next area. So we've got a lot of information that's being processed, and it has to go across that network, and it has to go through your computer, or at least portions of that have to go through your computer. And yes, we are constantly playing a catch-up game. I remember years ago, our networks these days, between your computer and the server, your first link is running at probably one gigabit. I remember computers running on a network at one of the first companies I was an IT professional for. We were talking about 1.2 megabit. 1.2 megabit. So you've got roughly an understanding here. It's a little bit better than dial-up speeds from way back in the day, but it's not a whole lot. So we've had to adapt along the way. We've had to slowly ramp up the networks throughout. We've had to ramp up the computers. But a lot of this comes with budget. Well, we're going to allow you to spend this much. No. We need three times that much. For us to do all of the things that you've told us we need to do, you need to give us three times the amount of money. Well, you're just a cost center. I've heard that many times. IT is a cost center. Fine. If we're a cost center, do without IT. Sure. Let's see how long the company lasts with that. But that's my cynical side coming out. The issue is, yes, IT is not sitting here and is not intentionally finding ways to slow your computer down. All of us nerds, all of us IT nerds, computer nerds, we actually have a certain level of obsession with trying to get better throughput, trying to get better efficiencies out of computers, out of the network, and finding all of the bottlenecks that are occurring with the application and everything else. But we only have so much time and so much energy to apply all of these different things across not just your computer, not the computer sitting next to you, but for all of the computers throughout the entire company. And some of us don't rise up to the level in management, IT management, to have a distinct dramatic effect on your computer and technology performance. And that's unfortunate. But there are also other people that are deciding along the layers up through the IT department of where do we focus our energies? Where do we direct all of this IT infrastructure to make us the most effective we can be for this company. And that's the focus. So we have to prioritize. And I don't care if it is one technician that's coming in a matter of 10 hours a week, or if it's a team of 100 technicians working full time. There's a certain level of prioritization, and sometimes speed is good enough. It's not ideal, but we have to work with it. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. We tend to view major technology developments at home as always being less than perfect. There seems to be always cost overruns and delays in delivery, while competitive projects abroad are assumed to always be perfectly executed. Rarely do we hear or read about the failures abroad. A major technology undertaking by the Chinese government is Made in China 2025 in the Semiconductor Self-Reliance Plan. Well, those plans are not moving along as planned. Tsinghua scraps 3D NAND and DRAM factories. Investors are forcing restructuring of Tsinghua Unit Group. According to a report from Nikkei, debt-stricken Tsinghua Unit Group will scrap plans to build two large 3D NAND and DRAM factories and reshuffle Unisoc as part of its restructuring plan. Both moves represent major setbacks for China's Made in China 2025 Semiconductor Self-Reliance Plan. Tsinghua Unit Group will axe two major semiconductor factory projects in China as part of the ongoing restructuring procedures, a serious blow for the country's semiconductor self-sufficiency goal as local memory production is a key part of the plan. The move will impact the global supply of 3D NAND and DRAM and thus affect memory prices 2 or 3 years from now. In addition, Tsinghua will reorganize Unisoc, the country's largest developer of a mobile system on the chip, which might be good news for MediaTek and Qualcomm, but another major blow for the self-sufficiency plan. The new factories are scrapped, and Tsinghua Unit Group already owns Yanxi Memory Technologies Company, that's YMTC, a rapidly developing yet still fairly small 3D NAND producer. The company announced intentions to build a 3D NAND and a DRAM factory worth $30 billion in 2017. Still, the initiative has been reconsidered several times. The locations of the factories were changed, the amount of money to be invested was projected to increase, and has never materialized. After Tsinghua Unit Group faced major financial difficulties last year, the destiny of both projects was completely uncertain, especially amid tensions between China and the United States. Tsinghua Unit Group's second 3D NAND project was essentially meant to replicate Yanxi Memory Technologies' success. Yet still, Yanxi Memory is yet to become a rival for Samsung Semiconductor and SK Hynix, two South Korean companies that produce 3D NAND in China. It did not really make much sense to build yet another factory, which could cost as much as $24 billion. To build its DRAM operation, Tsinghua hired a former chief executive of Elpida Memory, who has experience in competing against companies like Samsung and Micron. However, he left Tsinghua in the second half of last year after the company faced bankruptcy, even before he could use his knowledge and connections. Since it would have taken years and cost billions of dollars to develop a competitive DRAM process technology amid uncertainties with a supply of fab tools in 2025 and 2026. Tsinghua reportedly axed its DRAM intentions too. Unisoc is a smartphone and tablet system-on-a-chip developer, is yet another Tsinghua Unit Group business unit to be restructured. The company mostly sells inexpensive 4G devices. It barely brings in huge profits and cannot compete against system-on-a-chip designers with 5G-supporting products. The current plan includes further consolidation and relocation of existing engineers. It will also postpone the realization of ongoing projects, possibly including the development of 5G system on a chip. With many assets under its control and huge plans for expansion, Tsinghua Unigroup owed approximately $31 billion and had $8 billion in cash and cash equivalents as of mid-2020. Yet it had defaulted or cross-defaulted on 7 bonds worth $3.6 billion by the end of 2020. Late last year, two new investors, Beijing Jianguang Asset Management Company and Wise Road Capital, emerged as new backers of Tsinghua Unigroup with new investors on board. Tsinghua Unigroup will be more financially stable than before, but scrapping two major semiconductor projects emphasize that the goals of the Made in China 2025 projects ain't going to happen at all, are not going to be achieved. Why China's semiconductor industry remains behind in technology? There are three primary factors. The education level of the labor force in the United States is composed of 45% high school graduates and 45% college graduates. In China, college graduates and high school graduates is made up of 12.5% and 28.8% respectively of the workforce. China's high school and college graduate numbers are lower than Mexico, South Africa, the Philippines, and Malaysia. Although China's level of innovation is high compared to other countries, China cannot effectively compete with developed countries with its low education rates. Then there is a supply chain. According to a January 2021 report from Georgetown University's Center for Security and Emerging Technology on the semiconductor supply chain, the United States semiconductor industry contributes 39% of the total value of the global semiconductor supply chain. U.S. allied nations and regions, which is made up of Japan, Europe, especially the Netherlands, the United Kingdom and Germany, Taiwan and South Korea collectively contribute another 53%. Together, these countries and regions enjoy a competitive advantage in virtually every supply chain segment. The most immediate issues China faces in its semiconductor industry are competitiveness and quality. Although China has some of the required technical capabilities, it does not have all or enough of them. Zosyn, a Chinese semiconductor company, is the only Chinese company to produce x86 CPUs. Huawei and Tsinghua Unigroup each have their own subsidiary producing semiconductor logic chips, but they license core intellectual property from a British company. Despite being one of the world's top five semiconductor foundries in the world, SMIC, which is the Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation, only began to produce 14-nanometer semiconductors this year. That makes it three generations or at least 6 years behind its rivals. Why is China's market share and quality so low? Its rivals have most of the latest technology. China does not. One of China's top initiatives is to promote innovation. China's government assistance to its semiconductor industry is equivalent to 137% of the Chinese semiconductor industry global sales, compared with just 11% for Japan, 3.8% for Taiwan, 2.3% for the European Union, and a minuscule 0.01% each for South Korea and the United States. China's goal is to expand into foreign markets, secure access to foreign suppliers and consumers, and establish technological standards in information and communication technology. If successful, it will provide demand for the steady economic innovation that China needs. China's success is facing competition abroad. The most formidable obstacles to Chinese economic innovation are domestic. China became a leader in 5G technology, but its level of innovation lags in a different sector. China's primary innovative challenge is its lack of capabilities in high-value digital hardware, particularly semiconductor logic chips. In the past decade, from 2010 to 2020, China attempted to consolidate the semiconductor industry, encourage domestic semiconductor companies to share research and development, have foreigners reduce export controls, and gain human capital with high skills from foreign countries. And early this year, however, China still does not design or fabricate a substantial number of highest value semiconductor logic chips. Chinese market share is less than 1%, and China's share of the global market is less than 6%. The two highest value semiconductor logic chips are central processing units, that's the CPU, and the graphics processing units, that's the GPU. Chinese produced chips are not only lower quality, but uncompetitive even in China. Generally speaking, China designs memory chips, which are easier to produce than logic chips, and is a leader in semiconductor assembly and packaging. Thus, while China is making progress in the design of semiconductor logic chips, it still largely produces lower quality semiconductors. The government's Made in China 2025 strategy intend to supply 70% of China's semiconductor demand. Looks like they're not going to make that goal. In their current state, Chinese semiconductor companies cannot meet Chinese demand for semiconductors, much less global demand. This means that Chinese manufacturers will remain heavily reliant on high-quality semiconductors produced overseas. Having declared high-end semiconductors a strategic industry in the early 2000s, the Chinese government now understands that developing capabilities in this sector is a decade-long process. You can throw a lot of money into it, but in education, where the long-term battle is won, China is behind. As we stream more movies and TV shows, play more online games, and make more video calls than ever before, and all this activity puts a heavy load on your Wi-Fi network. We know the latest Wi-Fi 6 standard offers a range of benefits, including faster and more reliable access. There are many ways to make your internet faster. Well, there's another standard that just came out, and it's called Wi-Fi 6E. How does Wi-Fi 6E fit in? Well, Wi-Fi 6E is a name for Wi-Fi 6 devices that operate in the 6 GHz band. It's a new swath of unlicensed spectrum that more than 58 countries across the Americas, EMEA, and APAC have made available for Wi-Fi to date. Until now, our Wi-Fi operated on two bands, 2.4 GHz and 5 GHz. The Wi-Fi 6 standard employs various features to improve the efficiency and data throughput of your wireless network and reduce latency for these two bands. Wi-Fi 6E extends the capacity, efficiency, coverage, and performance benefits of Wi-Fi 6 into the 6 GHz band, with up to 7 additional 160 MHz channels available. Wi-Fi 6E devices deliver greater network performance and support more Wi-Fi users at once, even in very dense and congested environments. Each band is a chunk of frequency. The 2.4 GHz band comprises 11 channels that are each 20 MHz wide. The 5 GHz band has 45 channels, but they can be fused to create 40 MHz or 80 MHz channels, enabling them to transmit more data at once. The 6 GHz bands support 60 channels that can be made up to 160 MHz wide. That's a huge chunk of extra capacity. Think of it as going from a single track road that's 2.4 GHz to a three-lane highway, 5 GHz, to a six-lane superhighway, 6 GHz. The analogy works for coverage too. Higher frequencies have a tougher time penetrating solid walls and floors, so the single-track 2.4 GHz roads reach further than the 5 GHz highways, which reach further than the 6 GHz superhighways. Wi-Fi standards have traditionally been quite confusing. The Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, that's the IEEE, establishes Wi-Fi standards. And those standards are certified by the Wi-Fi Alliance, which currently has 866 member companies, including Apple, Facebook, Google, Intel, Microsoft, Qualcomm, Samsung, Sony, and many more. The Wi-Fi Alliance realized correctly that a standard named IEEE 802.11ax might be easy for nerds to understand and grasp, but it was rebranded as Wi-Fi 6, which is the consumer can identify with. This move retroactively makes the IEEE 802.11ac standard Wi-Fi 5, and the IEEE 802.11 becomes Wi-Fi 4, and so on. Each of these standards is an umbrella term for a range of new features and improvements. To give one example, Wi-Fi 4 introduced multiple input, multiple output technology to allow for multiple simultaneous transmission to and from a device. The second wave of Wi-Fi 5 products introduced multi-user input and output, enabling multiple devices to connect simultaneously to send and receive data. Wi-Fi 6 improves the Wi-Fi 5 standard and introduced orthogonal frequency division multiple access, enabling a single transmission to deliver data to multiple devices at once. The range of improvements and technologies in Wi-Fi 6 and Wi-Fi 6E is the same. The need for the E comes from opening up of that 6 GHz band. Do you need Wi-Fi 6E? If you're shopping for a new router or looking at mesh systems, you would certainly want to look for Wi-Fi 6 support. There are many other ways to make your Wi-Fi faster, but buying a Wi-Fi 6 router is an important one. It brings all the benefits, including improved security through WPA3, which is Wi-Fi Protected Access 3, and reduced battery drain, courtesy of TWT, which is Target Wake Time. Whether you need to consider Wi-Fi 6E is a trickier question. In addition to the already mentioned shorter range, the other big problem with Wi-Fi 6E is that it requires new hardware. And right now, it's very expensive, and only routers and devices with Wi-Fi 6E support can operate on this newly open 6 GHz band. Existing Wi-Fi 6 routers and any older devices cannot and will never be able to. Opt for Wi-Fi 6E, and you're unlikely to see a lot of benefits in the short term. Wi-Fi 6 is enough for most people right now. On the other hand, all of these standards are backward compatible, so if you have deep pockets and to spend a little money and want to be future-proof for a while, then you might consider Wi-Fi 6E. There will be a wide variety of choices at different price points this year, and more than 58 million Wi-Fi 6E access points will enter the market in 2022. When purchasing Wi-Fi 6 and Wi-Fi 6E routers, consumers should always look for the Wi-Fi certified label to help ensure the product delivers a strong WPA3 security and interoperability with other devices in the home. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. Reflections on CES 2022.
Marty Winston joins me now here on Computer Talk Radio. Marty, let me ask you this. What was the first decade that you went to CES, aka the Consumer Electronics Show?
It was. Now, for those of you millennials, you won't remember this. Your parents might, your grandparents will. It was the 1970s.
Okay. All right. And so a few years ago.
It was a couple a year, one in Las Vegas, one in Chicago. And you might have 40 or 45,000 people show up, and it wasn't a terribly crowded room, but it was busy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And by every coincidence, in January this year, we had 40 to 45,000 people, and it wasn't crowded. It was a CES with elbow room.
Elbow room? That sounds like bowling room.
Well, they did not put anything. nothing was in the South Hall. This is Las Vegas Convention Center.
All right, yeah.
Not upper, not lower. It was in the North Hall, the Central Hall, the West Hall, and on two levels of the Venetian. And
wow.
I walked the entire exhibit area on the Tuesday when the show opened on Wednesday, so I didn't have anybody in my way.
No, of course not.
And
wow.
All I had to contend with was one very bad blister.
Wow. Okay, so my first year at CES, we'll say about 13 years ago, I remember it was making some big headlines because it was the first one going over 100,000.
Yes, and they hit 120 to 140 somewhere at their peak. Of course, who can tell?
Oh, more than that.
Well, I had that many badges myself. I mean, who could tell?
Yes, you are Marty. How many badges do you have? You've got like 8 different badges. Marty Winston, Lord Marty Winston. Yes.
It was also the first CES
mm-hmm.
with gaps in the floor plan. Places where concrete squares existed where exhibitors were to have been, but they all pulled out.
I saw pictures of the show floor and yes, those big, huge gaps. Shocked is not quite the right word. Dismayed is in a different direction and not the right word. But so it was distinctly different than you're used to.
It was that. It was absolutely that. Now, let's see what else I can tell you.
Was there anything earth-shattering there?
There was some wonderful stuff there, and there was a lot of junk there. So which one do you want to hear about?
Let's actually go. You know, I mean, you and I have spent many seasons of talking about the junk. Let's talk. There had to have been real stuff that was worthwhile going for.
Now, I'm going to go even deeper geek than usual because the things that were there that impressed me won't impress most of the listeners right now, but it will show up in products that they use in the next 6 months, year, 2 years, 3 years.
Okay, yeah.
Part of that, and this is kind of on the borderline between impressive and junk in my mind, there was a company that had batteries, largely rechargeables, made with a thin layer of graphene.
Okay.
That's a form of carbon, and graphene reduces the resistance between areas of the battery, and as such gives you slightly higher voltage, slightly longer service life before mm-hmm. the battery fades. So it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Except that when I try to buy a bunch from them, I offer to buy a billion batteries, and they said, well, we can't make those. Now I'm in a position where I can buy a billion batteries, so they have some gravitas for them.
Yeah, okay.
I also met Seoul Semiconductor, S-E-O-U-L, the city in Korea.
Okay.
And as it happens in my Air Force career, I was in Seoul at AFKN, which is the American Forces Korea Television and Radio Network.
Okay, yeah.
And when I chatted with the guys, and I'll tell you the tech angle on this in a second, they said, oh, AFKN? We all learned English by watching.
Nice.
Yeah. Seoul Semiconductor mm-hmm. makes billions of ultraviolet solid-state emitters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've gone over this. Solid-state emitters in ultraviolet, UVC, very, very low power compared to what you get from gas discharge tubes. Mm-hmm. However, there are small places where that is exactly the intensity you want. And I was dealing in a small space, and I was very interested because the price, the power curve, everything else, very, very close to what I was looking for. So we'll be having more conversations.
Okay.
I'm loving that. There were a lot of medical. Actually, we should do a segment on the entire North Hall medical tech section and some of the things that were there.
Really? Okay. You know, let's talk about that next week. Let's go into that because I'm sure there was a ton of stuff that came out of CES that was trying to address the little minor news item we've been discussing for
most of this went a different direction.
Really? So it didn't. Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. All right. You know what? Hey, we'll still talk about it. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, February the 4th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, February the 5th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Their website is acgnj.org. The King's Byte Computer Club has a presentation, 5G Cell Phone Technology. Tuesday, February the 8th, meeting time is 7 p.m., and they'll be meeting at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. The restaurant no longer offers free Wi-Fi service at this time, and Vax ID and mask is required. For more information, the phone number is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a lightning talk presentation on portable applications and operating systems. Meeting is on Thursday, February the 10th, and the meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, February the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is limac.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation, Topics on Privacy. Thursday, February the 24th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is pcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening and for your support. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.